We're going to open the education, Senate education meeting today. And we have a lot of people on the agenda, so we are going to time people so they keep their comments fairly short. We have a couple of bills to get through, and then we have two bills that we're going to probably open at the same time that have to do with dyslexia, so people can talk about either one when they come up. And any children that stay and their parents allow it, I have chocolate truffles for all of you at the end. It's just I usually do that on Fridays. We don't have Friday here tomorrow. We're going to go into our districts and do stuff. So I brought enough for all the kids, maybe not all the adults. They usually, the adults like it more than the kids. But so if you think about it ahead of time, there's either dark chocolate, milk chocolate, extra dark chocolate, and white chocolate. So anyway. Thank you all for being here. It's really important for us to hear the voices of lots of people, and especially those in this particular case with respect to dyslexia. So, and being a dyslexic ADHD human being myself, it's always nice to see other people who have the same opportunities that I got to have, which sometimes were helpful, and other times were not so much helpful. So thank you all for being here. With that, we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1032, and just as I was saying, the dyslexic one's going to go a little later. Do you want, though I can, we have senators that we try to accommodate, so yeah, I know you guys. Yeah, you can go on up right now if you want, and Kate Taylor's, I think, here for a different bill later. Okay, so do you want us to get a hold of you? You want us to open just for you to give a testimony? What would you like us to do at some point? Okay. The people would probably like to hear you at the same time they're testifying. So if you want to come back a little later, we can get a hold of you. We will call you.
Taylor.
Oh, both of the dyslexia bills. So with that, we have opened it. We'll have a short explanation. And while we're doing that, if you have testimony that's going to be a PowerPoint, we don't have the ability to have the timer and the PowerPoint. So make sure that the PowerPoint gets put on the website so everybody can see it at some point, and we will take care of that with our staff. So with that being said, I don't know if anybody has a PowerPoint. Mostly we don't, but I just thought I'd mention that. With that, short explanation, and then we'll...
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1032 removes the $10 million cap on the Oregon Promise grants per fiscal year. It reduces the amount a person receives by $50 for each term the person receives a grant. Dash 1 amendment allows students who were unable to meet the timeline for enrollment in the Oregon Promise program because they were either officers in an agricultural student organization approved by the Oregon Department of Education or experience a significant hardship to maintain their eligibility for the program.
Okay. With that, Senator Thompson, it's really nice to see you here.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithicum, and Committee. I'm actually here today on the behalf of myself also, but Senator Hansel. Oh, Chuck Thompson, I always forget this, District 26. And I'm also here for Senator Hansel. He couldn't be here. He had to head out and get back into his district. But he asked me to speak to the Dash 1 Amendment, which, and I was in FFA myself growing up as a kid. I'd never reached the level that the students that this affects are, but after you become a senior in high school, there are six members in FFA that are chosen to be the state officers, and they actually take, they have, I mean, they give up going to school, they make a lot of sacrifices to be these officers for FFA for the year. And the way the Oregon Promise is written, it takes those six kids out of a chance to get the Oregon Promise a year after they've graduated. And so the Dash 1 Amendment addresses that. And the amendment also gives the commission the ability to waive the requirement for students to enroll and participate in the Oregon Promise within the six-month time frame if they have experienced a significant hardship. So I ask you to please pass the Dash 1s. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. You probably believe you have seen this bill before, and you actually have. It was SB 55 before. The chair was good enough, and the chief sponsor of the bill at that time, Senator Haas, was good enough to let us use that bill as a vehicle to address an issue that we had in this biennium with the Oregon Promise. where even more young people were taking advantage of the program than we thought would be taking advantage of it when we first put in place the program. I am here very much to speak in favor of 1032, but I might digress a little bit. I do have a prepared statement, but I'm going to digress a little bit from that and just tell you a little bit how about my sort of personal feelings about this. I've been involved in these discussions for quite a long time in this building, and for some of you that have been involved that long, I was back during the early discussion of what we called the shared responsibility model. And we had a system then for the opportunity grant that basically paid about 11% of the cost for students. We appropriated a certain amount of money to it, and when the money ran out, the support ran out. We thought we were doing a great thing when we, one year next, as we were putting it together, we decided we would appropriate enough to basically give this to all students that applied. The reality is that we were able to do that. Then we were going to put in place this great program that would impact not only very low-income students in the state or very high-need students, but would actually address that need that we all know exists for people that are lower middle income or higher lower income, however you're going to phrase it, that just don't fit into the lowest income and the most Pell eligibility. The reality is simultaneous going into that, the recession hit, and we have never been able to fund the underlying program at anywhere close to what it would take to meet those earlier objectives. In a sense, when that happened, we lost the potential to help those individuals that weren't the lowest of income. And I very clearly look at the Oregon Promise as an ability to help Oregon families that are trying to get their, I guess as I'm getting older, I'm referring to everyone under 30 as children, but that's probably inappropriate. But we're trying to get people into our post-secondary education that would not normally do that or would not normally take the step. And I think this program is perfectly designed to do that because you have to do it within a very limited time of your graduation. You have to have a certain GPA, so you have a certain possibility of hopefully succeeding, and you're taking on an opportunity that you perhaps would not take on. And all of us know is if you get into life, the more that you get away from high school, the more years that pass before you enter post-secondary education, the less the chance that you will actually end up with a degree. This program is clearly geared towards people either getting a degree or getting some type of technical skill that can employ them. We know that over 6,000 Oregon students have actually benefited from this program. We know that there is a debate in this building about what the parameters of this program would be. We also know that the original measure included a limitation of no more than appropriation of $10 million per year in a biennium, which is why when it is expressed in CSL in our budgets, it is actually only at $20 million because that's the statute and that's how you create CSL as you go by the statutory language that we have. The reality of if the program is to continue under its current status, in terms of trying to fulfill its entire mission, we would actually have to appropriate somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 to $45 million, approximately $20 to $25 million more than we actually have in the CSL budget. Whether or not we are able to do that probably depends upon other factors in this building, what our ultimate level of funding is for programs, but I think it's very important to get this bill to Ways and Means so we have the ability to lift this cap, so we can have that discussion, and dependent upon the resources that we have, we can see at what level we can fund it at, and if it needs modification, then we can have those discussions at that time. I will assure you that when those discussions happen, it will not be something just totally in the subcommittee. I'll be clear to actually ensure that people on this committee and the advocates in this committee are involved in that, and other advocates both outside and inside the legislature and involved in those, both on the House and Senate side. But it's important that this bill gets to Ways and Means so we have a vehicle to address that cap. Finally, I would say I'm fully supportive of the Dash One amendments. It seems to be an oversight in the original creation of the program. In all reality, I think there is a lot of debate in this building about who we should be actually providing support for and whether we should be providing support for this student or that student. I'm just actually happy to see an Oregon student in the post-secondary system.
Any questions for either of these two? Thank you very much. I appreciate you being here. We're going to next have Ben Cannon and Emma Calloway. As they come up, I can't help myself as an old principal. For the students that are here, This bill is called the Oregon Promise. It's about allowing every student that graduates from a high school with a 2.5 GPA or higher to go to a community college with no tuition expense. The state picks up the entire expense. And we started last year after a program, and Senator Hass was the sponsor, after a program in Tennessee. And it was so successful in Tennessee, and then the same success here. We had an enormous number of kids apply. Those that did it have stayed in school the whole time. It has continued to make them more, and we'll hear a little bit more about that. So, Ben, want to go first?
Great. Thank you. Thanks. Senator Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We are the commission and agency that administers the Oregon Promise program as a result of the legislation that passed in 2015. And I will be very brief in my comments today, in part because you heard from us when you considered Senate Bill 55, which was the sort of predecessor bill, as Senator Devlin noted. We brought that bill forward on behalf, or the governor brought that bill forward on behalf of our commission, and we support this effort to continue funding the Oregon Promise with the similar eligibility terms to what exists today. And, of course, removing that statutory cap would be necessary if we're going to continue to serve the programs for whom serve the students for whom the Oregon Promise was designed to serve. Just a couple of notes about the program's impacts now that we're in the sort of second term of actually serving students. We examined our fall 2016 enrollment to prior enrollment cohorts directly from high schools. When we look back to fall of 2014, for example, we saw nearly 900 additional students matriculated in community colleges directly from high school compared to 2 years earlier, which was at the time the most recent data set we had. It seems logical that this program is the cause of that significant increase in the number and percentage of recent Oregon high school graduates who began at community colleges. 47% of those students are Pell eligible, meaning they're low income, they qualify for a Pell grant, and 44% of those students report themselves to be first generation college students, the first in their family to be attending college. A third of those first generation students report that they would not have gone to college without the Oregon Promise grant, so this program is the reason why they set foot on a college campus this fall. And our retention rates term to term, and of course we're only in our second term, so we're still getting our hands on this data, but they appear to be very high. These students, again, likely because of the financial assistance that they're receiving through the program, are retaining and persisting at high rates. As to this bill, the Dash 1 Amendment is something we've reviewed. Appreciate the consideration that it provides for students, the small number of students who participate in the Future Farmers year post high school, as well as the opportunity that it provides for the commission to create a waiver process for students who may experience extreme hardship and for that reason can't meet the requirement that they were enroll in community college within 6 months. And we're prepared to adopt a waiver process that would, in very limited cases, extend that six-month eligibility window. There are a couple of additional technical issues that we hope to work with the legislature to address, one having to do with the timing and process for assessing the $50 copay. So while, Senator Roebling, you're correct that this essentially brings tuition down to free or near free for students, there is that $50 provision, and we have some challenges, or I should say the colleges really have some challenges in how that that copay is processed, and there's some language that we think could help to get at that. We also, there's a technical issue. The law requires continuous enrollment on the part of students in order to stay eligible for the grant, with the exception of the summer term. We want to make sure that that is sensibly applied to students who begin in winter or spring rather than the fall. Of course, the vast majority of students participating in this program begin in the fall term, but students who graduate early or late, perhaps, from high school may take advantage of the program by beginning in community college in a winter term or spring term, and the way continuous enrollment is currently defined in the law may not make that possible for them. So there's another essentially technical issue that we'd be interested in working with the committee to address. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Government Relations Director for Portland Community College, and I wanted to briefly express our support from Portland Community College for lifting the cap and allowing us to have a conversation about continuing to fund the students who are currently in the program. We know that stability in funding is one of the most important things that we can provide to students as they're making the difficult decision to invest their time and money in our institutions. We also look forward to working with the HEC on simplifying the fee process and believe this is a good first step. And as the state continues to grapple with disinvestment in our institutions, we appreciate all conversations about affordability, including this one. So thank you very much to Senator Haas for your leadership and to members of the committee. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, thank you both. That's everyone who has signed up. I don't see anybody else out there. We will put this quickly to a work session in the future. If you have any ideas about any other suggestions, let me know. But otherwise, we'll put it on for as soon as we can. So with that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 1032. And now you get to hear about another exciting program for kids that you can take advantage of. And that's going to be opening a work session, public hearing for Senate Bill 297. We'll open that session. You can say a little bit about the bill. And Senator Denbrough, and who else do you want to bring up?
Jim Pyro and Brian.
Well, the bill is?
Chair Roland, members of the committee, Senate Bill 297 abolishes the Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math STEM Investment Council, establishes the Career and Technical Education CTE STEM Investment Council in the Chief Education Office. It establishes membership and meeting requirements, outlines the purpose, duties, and responsibilities of the council, requires the council to develop and oversee a long-term strategic plan, and provide regular reports. The bill requires the council to make recommendations on applications to the Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program. It establishes a grant committee for that program, revises methods for awarding grants related to STEM education and to CTE that can lead to high wage and high demand jobs.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Michael Denbrough. I represent District 23 in the Senate. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland. And I'm really pleased to bring you this bill, Senate Bill 297, which is really the next step in a process that the legislature has been involved in for 5, 6, 7 years now, where we have been really reinvesting in career technical education, and we have begun to invest in STEM. And those were processes that kind of came the ground up, but in two parallel sorts of currents. And the work to begin reinvesting in vocational ed, in what we now call career technical education, was focused on developing the CTE grant revitalization, the CTE revitalization grant program. And then the STEM effort came about through the creation of the STEM Council and STEM hubs and that kind of thing. But, you know, something that we probably, some of us knew from day one, and it became increasingly clear, is that the line between CTE and STEM is thin to non-existent, right? See, the focus of CTE, you know, is often on just a variety of technical kinds of occupations, STEM, engineering kinds of occupations. But where exactly in today's world do you draw that line? Right. You know, you think of a robotics team, and you have those kids who are really into the computer side of it. You have those other kids who are into, you know, the welding construction side of it. They work together as a team. And, you know, we recognized that back in 2011, I think, when we designated of those funds that were going to be invested in CTE grants, a certain percentage would be dedicated to STEM-type CTE activities, because we realized they really went hand in hand. we've been talking for some time about aligning these efforts much more closely, and we're talking seriously about it back in 2013. But back then, the changes in governance in our education system were unclear. So it wasn't clear exactly where a CTE STEM joined strategic council could be located. But we think now that the time has come, and I will turn things over to two people who've been working with each other and with me for years now to try to move this along, because it is so important for young people in this state to have pathways to opportunity that STEM and CTE will give them. So Jim Pyro and Brian Craig, I don't know who's going to go first.
Yeah, thank you for being here, since you are the two board people from the each opposite size, and it's nice of you to
I'm in the middle.
We're all going to come together.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, more to the point, at some point I'll leave, and it'll just be the two of them.
Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Pyro. I'm president and CEO of Portland General Electric, and I also currently serve as the chairman of the Oregon STEM Investment Council. And I'm here to speak in support of SB 297, which will really create an integrated CTE STEM governance structure, which I think is necessary to move our work forward. You know, our state is very successful right now. We're innovative. We have a burgeoning bioscience industry. We have the fastest growing in the area in the country for software development, expanding high-tech industry, a growing sportswear industry, a highly successful and growing agricultural industry. And with all that growth and success means that we need jobs and people to fill those jobs. The numbers are pretty impressive. The Oregon Employment Department is projecting about 147,000 jobs in the next 10 years that include a requirement of at least a high level of knowledge in one or more STEM fields. That includes 64,000 new jobs and 83,000 replacement jobs. When you sort that data on those jobs that require a bachelor degree or higher, the projection is 88,000 jobs over the next 10 years, or 9,000 jobs per year. So there's clearly a demand in the marketplace for those high-skilled jobs. When you look at the supply side, a study done by Eco Northwest showed that we're only graduating about 2.5% of entering high school students with a STEM degree. That's about 1,000 kids a year. So on the supply side, we're only graduating 1,000. On the demand side, we have a need for over 9,000, at least in the degree programs. So there's clearly a gap here that we need to fill, and we see how this bill can help us continue to move that direction. Our key job clusters in the state require a workforce with strong CTE and STEM foundations. We need engineers, scientists, designers, medical professions, developers, advanced manufacturers, teachers, and skilled trade workers, just to name a few. So the STEM Council was formed as an industry-led council to improve student outcomes to fill high-wage, high-demand STEM jobs. And we are making progress along that line. We've created the STEM Education Plan, which I have here, which was very well worked with the Chief Education Officer. And we've been working very closely with the Chief Education Office and the Oregon Department of Education with a strong equity focus. The STEM Council has done a lot. We continue to support the 11 STEM hubs across the state. We continue to work on the innovation grants. We have grants in math and real life, adaptive math, digital literacy, and out-of-school innovation. But our work to date has not integrated CTE and STEM, and that's the point I think Senator Demereaux is trying to make. It's been kind of separate, and we really need to bring those together, because that's how the learning experience works for students. So it makes sense to continue to move forward and do this integration. We have a lot of support in this area from the CTE STEM Employers Coalition. And really, this effort, 297, recognizes the importance of integrating CTE and STEM education, because they are an natural extension of each other. And they are a pathway to high-wage, high-demand jobs. So the key elements of SB 297 is it creates an 11-member industry-led council that would be appointed by the governor. It unifies and aligns CTE and STEM governance, investment, and desired education and career outcomes. The council would be joined by an advisory committee made up of teachers and administrators with direct experience in CTE and STEM, and would also include members of the House, Oregon House and Senate, members with educational policy experience. The CTE STEM Council would serve in a recommendation role to develop and guide short and long-term strategies to improve integrated CTE and STEM proficiency, career pathways, and degree attainment. And the new council would set goals for Oregon through the P20 continuum, around strategies, policies, investments, and educational priorities in career-connected learning. And the council will then review the state's progress in achieving those goals and ensure that we're on the right path. So really, 297 aligns the results from a policy and investment focus to career-connected learning and does away with unnecessary division of CT and STEM governance. So while we've historically thought about CT and STEM differently, we really are trying to bring together, because from a student's perspective, it's all the same. It's that continuation of education and hands-on learning. So we are very supportive of this bill and would like to see it go forward. Thank you.
I gave him a little bit more time. We won't give you as much. No.
Sorry.
I will be brief. Senator Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. I'm representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association, SMACNA. My construction industry clients have been involved in this area since we started down a new revitalization path back around 2011 in pushing for growth in CTE programs across the state. It really took off at that point in time. I currently serve as the co-chair of the revitalization grant committee for the state. Last session, we passed a major bill, 3072, and that combined the STEM and CTE grants and programs and expanded a number of them. That was funded to the tune of about $35 million. $22 million went to CTE-oriented programs and 10 to STEM. But the thing is they really do overlap. And actually, I have uploaded a number of documents for you for afterwards. There is a great Venn diagram that shows the overlap and structures on there that I encourage you to take a look at on that. I've also uploaded a document about the CTE programs that has a nice map, shows what we've been able to do in 6 years, where we started with $0 and then we're coming up to a much larger amount as we keep growing. Leadership, getting it coordinated between the two, the grant committee and the council, is something both groups have been talking about, and so that we are putting together the programs in a way that we leverage the dollars that you give us in the most efficient way and we get the best outcomes possible. And having, we talked about actually maybe having a CTE council that would be just parallel to the STEM council, but then the industry folks, we are all talking about the fact is how many councils do we really need, how many do we need to be on? So there are some issues here of trying to get some synergy and a little bit of efficiency. We envision that the council will have quite a few subcommittees underneath it for a structure on it. So we know that today we're not ready to really move along with this bill. There are amendments being worked on. We had a dash one, but we'll be moving on to a dash two. We're in discussions with the Department of Education and the Chief Education Office about some of the things that would need to be done to make a structure that would work. But simply, we are really trying to combine the two things that already exist. It's nothing nefarious out there, but come up with a structure that'll work a little bit better for coordination and long-term success.
Thank you very much. Any questions for these? Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And we will look at all the information you have. We're going to go next to Richard Donovan, Morgan Allen, and Jan McComb. And since we want to ease from one to the other, we'll let Jan go first.
For the record, members, Chair Roblin, I'm Jan McComb, the Legislative Director for the Department of Education. The vision set forth by the proponents is a policy decision for you all to consider. The department's neutral on Senate Bill 297. There are a few issues we'd like to bring to your attention for you to consider. There's a governance change in Section 4 of the bill that moves the Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program out of the Department of Education and gives the funding decisions to the new CTE STEM Investment Council under the direction of the Chief Education Officer. ODE staff merely distributes the funds. This takes a K-12 program out from under the State Board of Education and Deputy Superintendent and places it with the Chief Education Officer, who would then direct ODE employees instead of the Superintendent of Public Instruction. So a little bit of a governance change might be something you might want to look at when you look at governance. Separating the funding decisions process from the staff that work with these programs every day and are familiar with them may result in less effective investments. The bill states that the Chief Education Office and the Bureau of Labor and Industries will appoint a grant committee to review the applications and make recommendations. The Department of Education doesn't play any role in that. despite our extensive experience and administrative rules in this area. Should the legislature decide to fund Measure 98, which deals with CTE, dropout prevention programs, and dual credit programs, that work by law comes to the Department of Education. It may not make sense to split up the management of these programs. Should the STEM Council take over the Measure 98 funds, the fiscal for the Chief Ed Office may be inadequate to cover their costs for this much larger complex program. Similarly, ODE receives federal Perkins funding to improve career technical education. It's not clear if that money would move to the new council or not, but again, it might separate these funds and not really achieve that vision of having everything all together. Some technical issues. The bill has BOLI and the Chief Ed Office developing criteria. It does not give those agencies rule-writing ability.
Okay. Well, we'll get some more. If there's any written, we want to look at it, too. So thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Chair Roble, members of the committee. Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. Thank you. I have submitted written testimony, so I'm going to speak briefly because I know there's time constraints. OSBA is in opposition to Senate Bill 297 as drafted. There aren't any amendments we're aware of. I understand from Mr. Krieg that they're not yet released. But the general tenet of the bill represents, I think, what something could be characterized as a hostile takeover of CTE by the kind of STEM Council. And OSBA feels that there's no need for this level of change. As our colleagues from the ODE mentioned, ODE has extensive experience. Their programmatic people are the people that go out and do the operational reviews of all these CTE programs. They're kind of the program level operators. And to the extent that we want a seamless system of STEM and CTE, and we thank the proponents of the measure for kind of prompting this conversation, OSBA doesn't feel that this bill will result in that. In fact, the opposite is possible, where there'd be just further siloing of kind of one group of industry-led policymakers, quite distinct and removed from the actual people who are distributing the money and checking the programs. And the level of influence here is quite profound over a very large amount of money, especially considering the fact that this bill would give this newly created council control over all of the ballot measure 98 funds. And so you're talking about tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of oversight in the middle of a time when that program is still very much under development. I know that my friend and colleague, Mr. Krieg, said that there's nothing nefarious here, but perhaps he doth protest too much. I'm not sure. There was a good reason for two parallel tracks when STEM and CTE were established. They're very different. Their aims are the same, but programmatically, they're distinct. And we believe, at least for now, they should remain so. This committee has advocated for a broader governance conversation. We would love for that, for this bill or this theme to be part of that conversation. Thank you very much.
Yeah, perfect. Morgan does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan Allen here on behalf of COSA. We also have major concerns about Senate Bill 297. I'll just mention a couple in the interest of time. The new CTE Council proposed by the bill creates a 25-member board, of which 11 of those members are voting members and actually have a say in how the money is spent. None of those 11 members are educators or representatives of K-12 school district staff or anybody that works in CTE or STEM in the K-12 system. So we're unsure why we need this council. There's already a STEM council. There's already an advisory committee that includes business, labor, and educators that advises the department about how to distribute CTE revitalization grants and other monies. We also have some concerns about turning over the decisions about how the money is distributed to the Chief Education Office and specifically the Chief Education Officer. While we don't have any concerns with the current Chief Education Officer, if we have a more lackluster Chief Education Officer, like, say, Rudy Crewe, we would have some major concerns about that person making these types of spending decisions. So, again, we're not quite sure.
I wasn't going to mention that. So.
We're not quite sure why the move away from the department and educators at the department who work with the districts on a regular basis have expertise and backgrounds in the field, and essentially they just become people, middlemen and middle women that just cut checks to school districts and don't really have any impact or influence on the programs. That is very concerning. So I'm going to stop there in the interest of time. Again, we would recommend that you take a look at this issue because I think the policy goals are important, but we know there's a governance work group that may be starting in a few weeks, and we'd recommend that this be part of that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? And Morgan, I owe you a piece of chocolate. You got done in under 2 minutes. So, So thank you all. Next, we will have Dylan McCann, Craig Hudson, George Granger.
Good afternoon, Chairman Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Craig Hudson. I work for GPS technology leader Garmin here in Salem. Today, I'm here representing kind of both sides of this as the co-chair of the South Metro to Salem STEM Hub, as well as a member of the CTE grant committee. And I want to speak in favor of the adoption of Senate Bill 297, a unified CTE and STEM investment council. Senator Dembro mentioned about the 5 or 6 years that we've been working on these pathways to opportunities, and Mr. Pyro and Brian Krieg have spoken also, and really we've had these two groups working very much separately and in silos, and there's quite a bit of synergy that I think we can find bringing these two groups together. So STEM hubs are really a systemic solution. They're not really a specific program or project, but rather they connect the dots together between those regional resources and assets, and they really help to prepare and engage the educators as well as the students. On the other side, the CTE programs of study are great at igniting student interest in math and science and problem solving, and these applied learning programs are a great way to engage students. So as I've been working with both STEM hubs and these CTE programs, I see them working together quite well, but to help us build a stronger and healthier CTE STEM ecosystem, bringing these two groups together would be of benefit. CTE and STEM learning opportunities abound in every community, but educators have not had a good way to engage with industry. Improving the access to high-quality, career-connected, and applied learning opportunities is paramount. The South Metro to Salem STEM Hub has developed a program called Oregon Connections. The goal was to create a searchable, matchable system in which every educator has an opportunity to connect with the real world and bring industry professionals into their classroom. I'd like to hand it over to Dylan McCann, who can give you a teacher's perspective on Oregon Connections.
Impressive. That was really close to Dylan.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Dylan McCann, and I represent Tuolumne Middle School in Tigard. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I've been actively involved in the STEM CTE training integration into my curriculum for the last 3 years. Since that time, it's dramatically changed my teaching philosophy, what learning looks like in my classroom, student involvement, and who they are learning from. In teaching grades 4 through 6, I focused most of my efforts on giving students real-world experiences and exposure to standards-driven curriculum, classroom curriculum. And said that 57% of men and 68% of women who work in tech were inspired to pursue those careers by one person, one event, or one class. My students see me every day, and it's they're used to me teaching them. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes a little bit too easy to tune me out, and for them to not to see the relevance of classroom for them in their personal lives and how it relates to them. This is why I really try to provide my students with as many hands-on opportunities that directly correlate to potential futures in CTE and STEM while addressing standards. In the past 3 years, through using Oregon Connections, my students have the opportunity to be face-to-face discussions with over 30 professionals in careers like computer programming, construction, pilots, rocket engineers, bakers, business owners, geologists, 3D printers, naval architects, and many more. I want to share with you I want to share a quick story with you. I was teaching a fifth grade girl in Malala. She was struggling with all of her subjects. She had really low self-confidence, and she saw all of her peers thriving in math and reading and writing, and she just could not. And about halfway through the year, she just gave up. She said to me on many occasions that she's just not good at it, and she can't do it. She's not smart. No matter how much I tried to let her know it wasn't the case, she just wouldn't believe me. I was teaching a quick little unit on... Okay.
Won't stop the story.
I was teaching a unit on computer programming, and I had a virtual session, just like a Skype interview, with a woman named Marcy Sutton, a programmer in Seattle. She's talked about how her roundabout journey to programming, what she likes about it, and some of the things that she opportunities she had because of it. The minute that session finished, this student came up to me and she says, "I want to be a computer programmer."
And from that day on, she started doing her homework, advocating for herself, trying harder. Her skills and test scores started improving, and I could see the light in her eyes, and this girl knew without a doubt that she could do it. The following year, I moved to another district, and she found my email address, my new district. She wrote me an email letting me know she had a B-plus in math and 2 points away from an A-minus. And she had the opportunity to see herself as a successful adult in this career, and that shifted her entire outlook on herself and her learning. And these are the moments that I strive for as an educator, and through integrating CTE and STEM education, I'll be able to provide more of my students these moments. Thank you.
Thank you. So he took your time. So, yeah, no.
Actually, sorry. Chairman Roblin, I can be very brief. This was a great story.
Yeah.
Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, I'm George Granger. I'm president of AT&T here in Oregon. But I'm here today in my capacity as advocacy chair of the Technology Association of Oregon. And TAO is very much in favor of this bill. I think you've heard a lot of powerful reasons why this is a great bill. It's important for Oregon's future to prepare our students in the way that has been described, and I think it is urgent for the state to look for the most efficient means of doing that. Oregon is becoming a destination for technology companies, and we want to continue that process. We also want to make sure that Oregon's innovation economy, which is leading us here in the 21st century, continues to grow and make sure that our students have a place in that important economy. I think this bill will really contribute to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
We have one last person for this bill, and that's Joel. Oh, two. I'm sorry. Don Domes and Joel Fisher.
Chair Roblin, for the members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher, here on behalf of Oregon Business Association and Associated Oregon Industries. We have been longtime supporters of both the CTE Revitalization Council and the STEM Council. Just want to copy and paste all the good things that people have said about combining these two councils. We think it's the right move. There's a lot of synergy there, and we think it'll be a more effective, efficient, streamlined way to administer these grant funds, which are again hugely important, and we support. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Another piece of chocolate. Yes.
Senator Roblin and committee, thanks for the opportunity. My name is Don Domes. I'm a licensed tax and small business consultant from Hillsboro, Oregon, and I'm also a retired CTE and science teacher of 36 years. While I love this idea of getting these things together, as we've talked about, I do have concerns about governance, but I want to take kind of a 40,000-foot level look at the team that is in the bill to put this together. As written, Senate Bill 297 has one CTE teacher from K-12 and one science teacher from K-12. As a tax and small business consultant, I've seen a few business plans. Typically, those things say that some group is going to invent a new product, patent the product, make the product, and then sell the product into the target market. Of course, the financials look great, and then we look at the bios. When we look at the bios, we're looking for people who've actually invented a product successfully, patented the product successfully, produced it in quantities successfully, and sold that product into that target market successfully. If I don't see a bunch of people with an actual track record of that, most of us don't invest in those things. This bill is written has only one K-12 CTE teacher and one K-12 science teacher. I implore you to change the language to three model K-12 CTE teachers with highly successful programs of study and three model K-12 STEM teachers with highly successful programs. This council needs practitioners that have actually delivered the desired results to the target market. If only one teacher remains written into the bill, please consider that if that one teacher is sick or has to be in their classroom, then that teacher will not be at the meeting. If the teacher is located a significant distance from the meeting, getting their participation is even more complex. I also suggest that the 11 council members be made up of at least 5 members who became successful via the CTE route and 5 members who became successful via the STEM route. Governance is a big issue, but I do really suggest that you include these two amendments to the team. We've got to succeed, and right now we're spending over $3 billion a year, and I got clients saying they can't get the right workforce, and I got people that I'm seeing that aren't making the kind of money they need to support themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for either of these people? And thanks for taking the time to be here. It is this information that helps us make better laws. And so I appreciate you being here, and we'll take that into consideration as we keep going. And no questions, so thanks. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 297. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1004. And with that, we'll have Alex Kyler first. Yeah, we'll do a summary real quickly.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1004 allows county governing bodies to dedicate up to $500,000 of federal forest reserve receipts allocated to the county school fund to career and technical training provided through the public schools under certain circumstances.
Alex.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. Here to speak to you on behalf of Senate Bill 1004. Lane County is, as I think the members know, one of the larger timber counties in Oregon. Between 2000 and 2007, when the original portion of the Secure Rural Schools Act was operative, Lane County was the largest recipient of national forest revenue in the entire nation. Okay, of all the counties across the U.S. that receive revenue share or Secure Rural Schools dollars, Lane County was the largest from the national forest. Now, under state law, national forest revenue is allocated to counties in a formula that involves 25% of the harvest, or in the case of SRS, the SRS dollars. That 25% under state law is split into two categories, 25% to the county school fund, 75% to the county road fund. So before you today is a measure that attempts to give the county a little bit more authority and enter into partnerships with local schools around the use of those dollars. In 2015, this body passed Senate Bill 482. In fact, I think, Senator Haas, you were a sponsor of that measure, and it established in statute the Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership. This is a federal designation that was given to 16 counties in Oregon and Southwest Washington to work on manufacturing issues, specifically around advanced wood manufacturing and cross-laminated timber development. What this bill is trying to do is create an alignment between the state programs, the county economic development and workforce programs, and CTE programs. And what it would do is allow the county to work with the schools to use money for those CTE grants. I want to point out in the bill that it only allows that to happen if there's a willing partnership. So you may hear testimony that this is like a money grab by the county, and in fact, it's not. When I was drafting this bill with LC, it was very clear under federal law that these dollars must go to public schools. Well, all this does is attempt to mark those dollars so the school may use those dollars, their first dollar, for a grant as a matching fund, for example, and it better aligns that economic development program, the workforce program, with the CTE, creating a nice pathway into this field.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Alex. So with that, we'll have our last group for this one, Richard Ozzie Rose and Lori Wimmer.
Thanks, Chair Roland, members of the committee. Again, Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. I have submitted written testimony for this measure as well, so I will keep it very brief. OSB wants to thank our friends in Lane County and for kind of spurring this conversation. It's the right conversation. Unfortunately, we're here to respectfully oppose the bill. School districts can do everything that the bill seeks to do already. They can do that with these funds. These funds exist, and school districts have maximum flexibility with these funds. The concern the school districts have is not maximum flexibility or something like that. It is adequately funding schools, and right now that's not possible given the level of state school funding. So unfortunately, any further allocation or prescription or kind of hold on student level funds is just one that we can't stand for. We would be open to amending the bill so that this funding came from county roads programs. That would be great for us. We would really enjoy that. But if not, we just unfortunately can't support this kind of allocation or hold on allocation with the that the proponents are trying to advocate for. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ozzie Rose. I represent the ESDs of Oregon. And very briefly, we oppose the bill because this can be done by local districts if they want to do it. This directs, or as the author said, puts a marker on money that's going to the schools for the school's purposes, and it's part of the spending from the formula, et cetera. And if you wanted to get to $10 billion or something for schools, we might think differently. But we have to make the decisions on the resources we have.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing 44,000 OEA members. And you have my testimony on the record, so I'll also be brief. We, too, oppose the bill for the reasons that you've already heard. We know that rerouting local revenues from the federal forest fee reserves to the CTE programs is something that would have an effect of, in effect, every school district would be subsidizing the Valley kids taking those courses because of the way the school state school fund works. This is local resources, and that's offset from the state school fund formula. So it ultimately amounts to a subsidy by the many for the few. Additionally, it takes the role of the school district out of the equation. We not only are far off from funding our schools adequately, but we're confronting the possibility of losing as many as 3,000 teachers in the next biennium, absent a revenue deal. And we also have both Measure 98 and the CTE revitalization grants, which are doing CTE in a different way yet. So though OEA was a partner with the NEA and the forest industries folks at the federal level to create the federal forest fees program, we know that sadly that program has ended, and these resources are also not a sustainable source because they will not be coming back. So this reserve fund is one thing, but that $1 million biennium ought to be to go where it was intended. That would take any questions.
Okay. So the only question I have is, so the way you see this bill written, since it allocates this money for a particular sense, it would become out of the portion that is divided up with the school districts for the general fund. So it would be taken out before they got their allotment from the state school fund. So it wouldn't be averaged with the, they would get theirs. Other counties that have the same sense would share theirs with the rest of the state. This one would not be shared with the rest of the state. Is that how you read it?
Mr. Chair, that's how I saw it, only because the federal forest fees have always been counted as local revenue in the state school fund formula.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, thanks for the question. I didn't actually read in. I think that's one possible way to read the bill. OSBA's concern is more that this would be an aggregate hold on some percentage of the per student monies. That whether it was local revenue or not, there would be essentially up to a $1 million hold over the course of biennium on some amount of funds, no matter how that shook out at the per student level. And we are having trouble funding schools adequately as it is.
Okay. I think that helps me. You guys destroyed my other bill earlier when you pointed out that when I changed from 11% to 13% for special needs kids, it reshuffles the money to other places. So I just wanted to.
We try to do that.
We do appreciate the fact
that it's not consistent.
Look at the stuff very carefully so that we don't hurt other people. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, that covers all the people in Senate Bill 1004. So we'll close that public hearing. And. Okay. We're doing this in the order of how many people are going to testify. So the next bill up is going to be Senate Bill 1003, which is nice because it comes just before 1004. Just so because there's fewer there, and then we have another one. We have the room just so you know, so people feel better, we have the room till 5:30, so we can go as long as we need to take testimony. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on, did I already do that? 1003. I'll do it again if I hit. With that, we'll have a short explanation. And we can start with Morgan Allen, Jared Mason Gear, and Lori Satinspiel.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1003 amends state law relating to dyslexia. Beginning in the 2018-19 school year, it requires school districts to ensure that at least one teacher in kindergarten through grade 5 at each school has received training related to dyslexia. It requires the Oregon Department of Education to develop a list of training opportunities related to dyslexia. It establishes requirements for the list. The bill requires school districts to ensure that every kindergartner or first grader is screened for risk factors of dyslexia. It requires ODE to identify cost-effective screening tests and develop and provide guidance. It requires ODE to submit a report to the Interim Education Committees of the Legislature summarizing best practices for screening students and instructional supports related to dyslexia. The bill takes effect July 1st, 2018. The Dash One Amendment makes technical changes.
And can we call Senator Daly?
Her representative is here.
Okay.
Michelle.
Okay. Oh, good. You're here. So that's great. So we'll make sure that she gets this as soon as she gets here. So with that. Okay. Oh, Michelle's going to do it. Okay. That's exciting. Go ahead. Okay. We'll let these guys go first, or do you want to take the senators? Okay, for them to go first. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Chair Roblin. Again, Morgan Allen here on behalf of COSA, and I want to offer comments in support of Senate Bill 1003 with the Dash One Amendment. As you know, last session we passed Senate Bill 612, which was a really important bill to address the dyslexia issue in our public schools. And if you remember, that bill did four things. Number one, it required that we'd have to get at least one teacher trained in all of our elementary schools to recognize and be able to work with students who have dyslexia or at risk for dyslexia. It authorized some funding to pay for that training out of the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, which Jared and I will be back later to make sure that money gets to that program. It created and funded a dyslexia specialist at the Department of Ed, and then it required the Department of Ed to create a plan to screen all kindergartners and any first graders that were missed in kindergarten for risk factors of dyslexia. So Senate Bill 1003 only addresses that fourth area, the screening, and it's our attempt to clarify and implement the original agreement that was negotiated on Senate Bill 612. And specifically, the bill does three things related to screening. Number one, it clarifies that the universal screening for risk factors for dyslexia is to be administered to all kindergartners, and then any first graders who maybe missed it in kindergarten or moved to the state and were not screened in kindergarten. The second thing it does, it clarifies that the screening will include checking for a family history of difficulty in reading, but only for students who actually present risk factors on the screen. The original bill required us to contact all 40,000+ families of kindergartners. We didn't think that made good sense. And then the last thing the bill does related to the screen is it directs OD to provide guidance on recommended best practices for student interventions rather than prescriptive direction to school districts. We added an additional piece to the bill to ask the department and our dyslexia specialist to come back in September of 2018 with recommendations on next steps for both screening and interventions. The bill has the support of OSBA and OEA. We worked with you, Mr. Chair, Senator Taylor, and representatives of the advocacy group Decoding Dyslexia to draft a Dash One amendment that we hope addresses their concerns about the original bill language. We've tried to be inclusive and fix a couple things they pointed out to us. So we encourage your support of the bill and encourage its adoption. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards. I want to echo Morgan's comments. One additional comment: when the original 612 bill was put in place, we were out in the field talking about legislative bills passing. Small and remote rural folks were concerned about how they were going to have the time and energy to create the trained teacher for in all the buildings K through 5. So you helped me. You helped us get this through in rural, I believe, is where the OD is handling this. Small remotes can access this particular teacher through ESD. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Jared Mason Gear on behalf of the Oregon Education Association and our 44,000 members around the state. Largely would just, again, echo the comments of Mr. Allen. I guess to stress just a couple of points that I think are really important. We were pleased to be part of the work group that created the final version of SB 612. I do think that there were two really important side effects that we're addressing here with SB 1003. for our members, the potential for an overly burdensome administration of the screenings, I think, was a very real issue. And then I think, again, the position that they were being put in with regard to the number of questions of parents around their potential reading difficulties was going to be pretty awkward and uncomfortable for a lot of people, in addition to being onerous given the workloads that they already struggle with. So we think that this is a really good compromise that we've arrived at here with this bill. Mr. Chair, appreciate the work that you've done and appreciate the work of Senator Taylor to help guide this forward. I think we're in a place that is ultimately going to make everybody happy. It's going to help ensure that we are identifying those students that need the additional help while still being something that can be administered properly and without being too burdensome for those that are actually working on the front lines in education. So I urge your support, and thank you.
Any questions for this group? Yes.
Just a comment to all three of you. You now have been enlisted to be part of the work group. Senator Manning and I are putting together. Morgan, I gave you the information earlier for a more comprehensive look at things. You know what
right.
I'm talking
I
about.
Yeah.
And you would. Your input will be invaluable. So. Okay.
So what Senator Cruz is talking about, for those that want to know, he's interested in anything that's come out medically over the last number of years that could help us identify different risk factors for kids learning of any kind, so autistic kids, all those kind of things. So because we know the earlier we identify, the better chance we have of being successful with some kind of intervention. And so we had a talk yesterday about Erlen issues. We've had other tests and stuff, and he wants to have a little work group in this next interim to try to figure out from the medical professionals, are there things that we should be knowing in education to identify these kids earlier? So that's the purpose of his question.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. So next we're going to have the gracious person that helps Senator Taylor. Michelle, come on up. You want some people around you, want to just be the highlight?
Okay. Oh, I can sit over here.
No, you're good. We'll have the parents come up afterwards.
Okay. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me today. For the record, I am Michelle Hansman, legislative assistant to State Senator Kathleen Taylor from Senate District 21. I am here today to read her testimony on her behalf. And she says, I am here today to quickly express my support for Senate Bill 1003 and the Dash 1 Amendment. I am so pleased that advocates and representatives from the education community could come together on the amendment and want to thank them for being so willing to collaborate. Not only do I support the work of decoding dyslexia, I am proud to call many of those members my constituents. I will leave discussions of the bill to the experts in the room. I urge your support for Senate Bill 1003 and the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. I appreciate your consideration of my support.
Have any good, tough questions for this outstanding assistant? I guess we don't have any questions. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you. So with that, we're going to have Chris. I like to apologize before I start to pronounce names. I have dyslexia. Some of the kids would understand that. I look at letters sometimes, and I could never make out what that was going to say. But it's Demino.
Very good. Demino.
It's not bad. Rebecca Hannafin and Susan Farmer.
Senator Roblin, I'd like to hold my testimony for the next bill.
We'll make sure you're on the list. Okay.
I am.
Thank you. I guess it's just you.
I guess it's just us. Senator Roblin and the committee, good afternoon. I'm Chris Demineau. I am a parent, a middle school teacher, a college instructor, and I am also dyslexic. I have traveled to Salem from Pendleton to share the importance of effectively screening students at an early age for dyslexia. It's also critical to continue to have input and voice from the specialists, administrators, stakeholders, and general and special education teachers who work with dyslexic and their families to have an advisory role in the continued development of Oregon's dyslexia program. I support the proposed amendment submitted by Senator Taylor, and I'm proud of the collaborative approach that the work group has taken in preserving the importance of early screening for dyslexia, supporting a clear need for a trained resource in dyslexia in every primary school, and assisting families in providing the resources and guidance for their children to get the education they deserve. One item that I strongly encourage this committee to consider to support vote through legislation is the inclusion of an amendment that would further continue the work of the Oregon Dyslexia Advisory Council. This council is a group of administrators, specialists, teachers, special education and general education, nonprofit stakeholders, college university faculty, TSPC representatives, representative from the Oregon Education Association, parents, and staff from the Department of Education. They had been charged to develop a plan for implementing Senate Bill 612, but as we can see today, the work of that body is not finished. Oregon is a lead member in a group of states that have recognized the need to address the needs of dyslexic children. California, Maryland, Alabama, Colorado, and the list goes on of states that have advisory councils for dyslexia. They've joined Oregon in the understanding of the need to include a wide and diverse group of people and organizations in the advisory and supportive role into the dyslexia specialists established in Senate Bill 612. As Senate Bill 1003 moves forward, it's important to recharge this ODAC group to continue to advise and support the work of the dyslexia specialists, ODE, and the vast network of schools throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for coming all the way from Pendleton.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Roblin and committee. My name is Rebecca Hannafin. My 8-year-old son was recently diagnosed with dyslexia, and I'm here today to support Senate Bill 1003 with the Dash 1 amendment. For many schools, screening kids for dyslexia is going to mean a sea change in the way that they think about struggling readers and the way that they interact with their families. The most frustrating part for our family has been convincing our son's school to work with us to identify his dyslexia rather than making excuses and putting endless roadblocks in our way. And accurate testing is an essential part of changing that culture. In first grade, I submitted written testimony, so I'll sort of skip through this, but they actually told us, the school told us, we want to wait until third grade to test your child because then it will be easier for us to measure the gap. So the school wanted our child to fall further behind because it would be easier for them to measure his failure. Accurate testing is so important, and it does need to include the four factors, and all of them, not just some of them, and the test needs to be effective and proven and not just cost effective for the schools. And I'm a little concerned about the current wording of the statute, that it gives a little bit too much wiggle room, in my personal opinion, on that cost issue. Our school's IEP eligibility test measures phonological awareness and rapid automatic naming, but then it blends those scores together to create a final score. So my son's the rare dyslexic kid who does well in phonological awareness but struggles enormously with rapid naming. So the test caught his disability, the scoring method hit it again, and he was denied an IEP. We then had to spend several $1,000 out of pocket for a private evaluation showing the school didn't know how to read their own badly designed test. Dyslexia affects 20% of the population. Having accurate testing, helping these kids, can boost our graduation rate. I do encourage you to pass the bill, but if we can strengthen it, that would be awesome. If I could,
sure.
I also submitted written testimony on SB 221. I just have one sentence I want to read from my son.
Go ahead.
He says he opposes the bill, my 8-year-old.
Wait one second. I'm going to open that one so they won't be ready because you're the last of the other one. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 221, and you'll get to be the first person to talk on it.
I will just stay right here.
Or your son will be the first to talk on it. Go ahead.
Okay. This is an 8-year-old. He says, I explained the bill to him, and I said, here's what they want to do or don't want to do. And he said, that doesn't make any sense. If the teachers don't know how to teach dyslexic kids, then I'm not going to be able to read. And if I can't read, I can't learn. And if I can't learn, I can't go to college. And if I can't go to college, I can't get a job. And if I can't get a job, then I'll be homeless. And I don't want to be homeless. Why don't they want to teach the teachers how to teach me? Thank you.
Thank you. So any other questions for this group? So thank you both for being here.
And Senator Roblin, I will be reappearing. I've also have comments with Senate Bill 221. But my daughters will also be.
You want to be there. Okay, that's fair. Thank you. We're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 221. 1003. We'll leave the other one open. And just before we get started, I do want people to really understand this has bothered our family, both all my brothers, there's three of us, all have dyslexia. One has been had a really horrible life, and I think directly attributable to Will. He had the hardest time dealing with his dyslexia. It was a lot worse for him. I grew out of mine, so I couldn't read till I was like fourth or fifth grade, but I got through it, and it was good for me. And so I understand, used to go into a lot of our special ed classes. We know now that if you can get the right application of the kinds of things people need to kids early, they don't have to ever have a gap. That would be really nice, because I don't think that they actually need to be identified personally for an IEP if we can take care of the problem because we teach it appropriately. So I appreciate everybody for being here, and all of these were a personal thing for me last time. They continue to be. My goal is to make sure we have the best program in Oregon. So that's what we'll figure out how to do. So with that, and our 221, we're going to call up Leif Gustafson. Come on up, Leif. Okay. And thanks for waiting here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak, Chairman Roblin and the Senate Education Committee. My name is Leif Gustafson. I'm the president of the Oregon Association of Colleges for Teacher Education and dean of the College of Education at Pacific University. I was also a middle school language arts teacher. I'm here speaking on behalf of OACTE. We're 17 public and private nonprofit colleges and university education preparation programs across the state in urban, suburban, and rural areas. All 17 member institutions support this bill. Our mission is to meet the needs of all children in our educational system, and it's essential that as a profession we continually improve and strengthen our pedagogical approaches in serving students who struggle with reading. Senate Bill 221 provides the legislative support to hold educator preparation programs accountable, remedies the concern of tying Oregon standards to the International Dyslexia Association, considers English language learners, and establishes a realistic timeline for CAPE implementation. By including the phrase standards consistent with an International Dyslexia Association in the law, the state concedes authority to an external organization to determine the teaching and learning methodologies teachers should use with children. We urge the committee to not limit teachers and students in this way. We want to use the best and most current teaching methodologies based upon research to ensure the highest quality of education for Oregon's children, including those diagnosed with dyslexia. By removing the language that ties dyslexia education to a particular organization, this legislation also recognizes the specific learning needs of English language learners, a growing population of students in Oregon who can also struggle with reading challenges. It's our goal to ensure these children have teachers who are prepared to meet their literacy needs. The language within Senate Bill 221 echoes the collaborative work that occurred in the Rules Advisory Committee of TSPC in October of this past year. In that committee, representatives from Decoding Dyslexia, K-12 schools, and educator preparation programs worked together to draft mutually agreed upon language for dyslexia education. Furthermore, the passage of SB 221 is important to provide the needed time for educator preparation programs that are not currently nationally accredited to become so. This is roughly half of the 17 educator preparation programs in the state. The three-year extension ensures that these programs have the time needed to plan financially, programmatically, and logistically for what is a major commitment. The three-year extension increases the chances that current education preparation programs will pursue and achieve national accreditation, which better positions the state to develop and support a sustainable teacher workforce. Therefore, we're asking on behalf of Oregon educator preparation programs that the Senate Education Committee pass Senate Bill 221 as written without amendment to the Senate floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Do you? I'll ask a couple. Do you feel comfortable in the conversation that took place during the summer with TSPC? Do you feel comfortable that if we take that language out, that mm-hmm. there that the phonetic kinds of teaching, I look at Orton and Gillingham methods and those kind of stuff, that those skills and techniques mm-hmm. necessary that mm-hmm. seem to work. I mean, there's research all over the place on this one, but for my brother, it was his savior. But if that, given the time and standards, that those kinds of tools and techniques, every teacher that goes through our programs is going to eventually have those skills, that toolbox to take to the classroom, so that when they find kids that are identified, they can then use whatever technique is best for that individual child.
Yeah.
And you believe that doing this, that will happen.
Yes, yeah. And that's exactly the goal, right, that the teachers that we're training go out into their classrooms and have that repertoire of resources that they need to be able to reach all different kinds of children.
So from my perspective, the two bills last year went together, one from the House, mm-hmm. one from the Senate. This is the House bill, basically, we're talking about now. And we put in there first, in our bill, we said every school district is going to have someone quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have to go out and find other programs to get that training, because we knew it wasn't there. But the long-term goal was to make sure that all these techniques were there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have watched, as a school person, we go through different times of picking a particular winner or loser with whatever we're taught in English or reading. And so whole reading was one. I had a daughter who was great at that. I mean, she didn't have any of my problems. I mean, she could read better than I could when she was born, it seemed like. She spelled better than me when she was three. So it's always been frustrating to me to have to ask her how to spell words, and she thought it was really fun that she could do that. So some kids, they just go that way, and
mm-hmm.
and doing anything else slows them down.
Mm-hmm.
There's another group of kids that if you don't have phonics, they don't have a chance. And for me, that was my experience. This non-phonics program, I just was first and second, kindergarten, first grade, just a blur to me. And then for whatever reason, they had a phonics thing come in, and all of a sudden it started having a little bit more sense to me. And by the time I was in middle school, I could actually read a book, which was really nice. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how do you assure us that teachers will recognize there's an issue, because that's been a problem. And once the problem is recognized, that then they will have the skills because of what our universities are teaching
mm-hmm.
to help provide what's needed for that child and to give assurances to parents that that's where we're working for. Because it's nice to have the one person in the school, but it would be really nice that every one of those teachers had skills to do that. And
right.
That's what we're hoping, that's what we want you to help provide us.
I understand
all the schools that do this.
So. Yeah, and Chairman Roblin, I mean, I appreciate that, and I think that the rules that were worked out in the RAC really do kind of lay out the expectations for the skill and conceptual knowledge that teachers need to demonstrate in terms of literacy and reading specifically, and when it comes to dyslexia. I think what I appreciate about SB 221 is that it's not an either-or kind of a situation. And what I hear you saying, I agree with that, whole language, phonics instruction, this isn't an either-or thing. The teachers that come through our programs need to have that repertoire of skill and conceptual knowledge and be able to listen and watch and learn with their students to know what needs to be employed when. And we feel that SB 221 honors that approach to, literacy instruction and reading more specifically.
Any other questions?
Just
yes.
A comment, Mr.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, just as a reminder, a historical reminder in this building that Senator Charles Starr was an advocate for a long, long time of going back to phonics.
Okay, good to know. I mean, I'm of the opinion as a math teacher that my responsibility as a math teacher was to figure out how that person sitting in front of me learned math best
mm-hmm.
and give them the opportunity to learn it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it came harder for me, but it came sooner than English ever did. And so in my life, it was always to figure out everything I could ever know about math, because I didn't know what that student across from me was going to need me to be able to explain it to him and have more than one way. I mean, I used to have frustrations with math people because they taught math by getting louder.
Mm-hmm.
That really doesn't help the child.
No.
It doesn't, yeah. For some people it did, but for me it was – try to give me another chance. And then I would say, there's thousands of ways. There are thousands of ways to teach every mathematic concept. And the fact that many of our teachers don't have that skill is very frustrating mm-hmm. to me because kids need that.
So, anyway,
and that's what I want in reading instruction because I would never try to do that because that's not what I did well, so it would be hard for me. So, okay, thank you. And you believe that the work group that worked during the summer helped work to this point, and that's why you think this is a good bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill, you want to come back again? Michelle, I'm sorry. I don't know why I did that. Michelle.
Thank you.
Or surrogate Senator Taylor.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me again today. For the record, I am Michelle Hansman, legislative assistant to State Senator Kathleen Taylor from Senate District 21. I am here today to read her testimony on her behalf. And she says, I am here in opposition to Senate Bill 221 and in support of many of my constituents who are members of Decoding Dyslexia. House Bill 2412 passed near unanimously in 2015 so that we can support the many students who are dyslexic. This will weaken the standards laid out by the passage of House Bill 2412 along with the timelines to accompany the implementation of those standards. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I appreciate your consideration of my opposition.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with that, we'll go back to our 2 minute, though you did really well. You were under 2 minutes.
She was under two.
So we'll start out with Aaron Prince and Cindy Roberts. We've also, and I'll also bring Chris. Oh, they went together. Got it. We're good. Okay.
Chair Robo, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm here. I said my last name wrong. That's the kind of day I'm having. Cindy Robert. And I'm here representing
I thought it was Robert. I was.
The Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. We have 18 schools in Oregon, and we represent 35,000 students. 11 of our schools are involved in educator prep programs, and so I wanted to tell you a little bit about why we are here in support of Senate Bills 221, Section 3. That is what we're here to talk about, both myself and Aaron. So in 2015, Senate Bill 78 made it changes to ORS 342, directing the TSPC to establish standards that require a teacher education program to be accredited by a national organization. In this case, we've chosen CAPE in Oregon. Previously, the TSPC set the standard, and there was no such accreditation on a national level that was required. At the time of passage, 8 of Oregon's 18 educator prep programs were involved somewhere voluntarily in the process of accreditation. Many of them had gotten part the way through to an NCATE accreditation, and CAPE was the very next step. All of our schools are involved somewhere in the process of the CAPE accreditation that was required under Senate Bill 78. And while we're dedicated to adopting high national standards that are embedded in the CAPE standard and certainly teaching some of the best student teachers that we could for Oregon, we do have concern about the timing. One of the key standards in the CAPE standards, there's 5 of them. Number 4 specifically requires data information that we just don't have. And I think TSPC would tell you we just don't have it. We're working towards it, but we don't have it yet. Standard number 4 requires the educator preparation provider demonstrate the impact of its completers on the P-12 student learning and development, classroom instruction, and schools, and the satisfaction of its completers with the relevance and effectiveness of their preparation. We just can't do that yet. So while we certainly hope to get there, and we're all going to work together to get there because we understand the standard's a good one, we need the 3 more years that Section 3 of Senate Bill 221 allows us to have.
Okay.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Aaron Prince, Vice President of Education Policy from the Chalkboard Project, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Section 3 on Senate Bill 221 as it applies to extending the timeline for university educator preparation programs to become fully CAPE accredited. Following a Chalkboard survey that was conducted through the Teach Oregon collaboratives across the state, an audit and report by the Secretary of State's office was filed in August of 2013. Both found that over half of our administrators felt teachers were not sufficiently prepared and teachers themselves did not feel fully prepared for the classroom once graduating from their prep programs. It also was evident that other states were further ahead of Oregon in the collection of valuable data that followed hiring and retention rates, success of teachers entering their first few years of teaching, and the development of strong collaborative partnerships between K-12 and prep programs. Additionally, the Governor's Council for Educator Advancement recommendations are built on the premise that all educator prep programs will gain national accreditation. Chalkboard Project's experiences from 3 years of Teach Oregon partnerships have served to emphasize the importance of strong collaborative partnerships and mutually beneficial commitments between university teacher prep programs and school districts. The need for collection of relevant evidence and data sharing between partners in the two state agencies, TSBC and ODE, is crucial to continuous improvement of these programs. Strong clinical experiences with carefully selected teachers and teacher candidates trained in co-teaching to enrich the clinical experience, along with the training of university supervisors, is another prime factor for ensuring success for the beginning teacher. Early recruitment efforts and support for culturally and linguistically diverse candidates is a program element that must be center focus for Oregon in our efforts to close the opportunity and access gaps in our schools. Recognizing the high level of rigor, collection of extensive data while systems are still being developed, and making program shifts, we at Chalkboard fully support the extension of the timeline through Senate Bill 221 for our university educator prep programs to successfully meet the accreditation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for these two? So the CAPE part, the Section 3, is different from the issues that have to do with the dyslexia part.
Correct.
And it's clearly about another national standard for, and it's, is it just in reading as well? I mean, is this language arts? Is CAPE across the board?
It's across the board.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
Fully accreditation.
Right, full accreditation.
Yes,
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cool. Okay, with that, we'll go to Chris Domino and Riley Domino and Kathleen, all with the same name, just to make it hard for me. And you came all the way from Pendleton. You also get the farthest from here award. So we always let people who are far away go first, other than the people you've heard before you. But then we go to you guys.
We get to spend a couple days at Silver Falls. So
that's really nice.
Yeah, we hadn't been there before, so we're excited about
doing
that.
So.
Once again, thank you for hearing our testimony this afternoon, Senator Roblin. One of the things that I'm going to speak briefly about with Senate Bill 221 is that we are deeply against the idea of it being removed from the idea of dyslexia and the international standards. 2412 was about dyslexia, and to pretend that it was not about dyslexia and try to remove the language about dyslexia, it really goes against what the original bill was clearly about. The state schools of education, I am a product of one of them myself, and I can tell you that I've received no education on dyslexia. There is a reason that that bill came up, is that the state schools of education have had decades upon decades upon decades to, on their own, teach the ways that our students need to be taught, and they haven't. We will hear testimony about the state schools of education being awarded grants and being awarded funds to continue their research and education. And they'll try to tell you that somehow by creating Senate Bill 221, that will somehow hand tie them into using that money to create even better educational programs. 2412 was about dyslexia. The state schools of education were not producing educators. I know nobody in my 19 years of education as a dyslexic that I went up to as a teacher. I'm talking thousands upon thousands of teachers with my role in the Education Association as a teacher in multiple states that have any training in education. There's a point that the bill was there, and I've closed my comments to remind us why we had it there in the first place and it needs to remain. And
thanks.
I'd like to introduce my daughter.
Yes.
Hello, my name is Caitlin Demino. I'm in fourth grade at Sherwood Heights Elementary School in Pendleton, Oregon. I was diagnosed with dyslexia when I was 7 years old. In school, I felt sad. My friends were reading fluently while I was struggling to figure out the words. The reason I can read is because my mom and dad purchased the Barton system and I'm tutored outside of school time. In school, I have an IEP, which gives me the extra time and more help in school. I think you should oppose Senate Bill 221 with Without it, teachers will not know what dyslexia looks like and how to help kids with a different brain like me. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you for being here.
So, good afternoon. Hello, my name is Riley Demenu. I am sixth grade at Sunridge Middle School in Pendleton, Oregon. I was diagnosed with dyslexia in fifth grade. In school, I flunked every spelling test, even when I studied all night on the spelling words. I felt I was dumb and could not do anything. I do tutoring two times a week. I just like tutoring because it takes time away from ballet, family, and friends. Being in sixth grade and almost 12 and doing tutoring is very embarrassing. If my friends and fellow classmates ask what I'm doing after school, I feel embarrassed to tell them I'm tutored. Everyone at school thinks I'm so smart and school is so easy for me, but it is really hard. I used to come home and cry because school was so hard. It's embarrassing to show people my writing because I think I'm spelling the words right, but my B's and D's and other words are sometimes totally wrong. At the beginning of sixth grade, my iWrity scores put me at the beginning of fifth grade. Now I already passed where I'm supposed to be at the end of sixth grade. Now teachers are saying I am one of the best writers in the sixth grade class. I think you should oppose Senate Bill 221. Teachers need to learn about dyslexia, what it looks like, and how to help the kids like me. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, and I will let you know, I got to be the first person to sit down every spelling bee we had in my school when I was in fifth grade, and my teacher finally decided to give me the same word every time. And I still don't like squirrels. I can't spell it. So I understand exactly what you're saying. So thank you.
Thank you for your time.
So our next group up would be Shannon Cooper, Monica McKee, and Kathy
Wyrick.
And thanks for being here. And whoever wants to start can go for it.
Okay. My name is Shannon Cooper. I am a teacher with K-12 experience with multiple endorsements in general ed and special education. I have studied the IDA standards, and I know they look daunting. However, I have looked at one university's general ed and MAT coursework, and more than 40% of the IDA standards are already embedded in its coursework. There was a time when one public university offered instruction and information on dyslexia. It was offered at Portland State University in a single 9-week class. I mention this offering at PSU because it was successfully done before and it can be done again. I have reviewed all 198 school districts' websites in the state of Oregon. There are many very small schools I've discovered. One district even sends their students across the border into Nevada for their education. These districts do not have the resources to have a specialist. Therefore, it's important for all teachers to know how to teach the fundamental skills and rules of English so they can help all their struggling readers. If an elementary school teacher does not have the competence in the fundamentals of reading, it's like a chemistry teacher who does not understand the periodic table. This is the rub. I have had student teachers from four different universities, and none of them have ever possessed phonetic skills beyond the mid-first grade level. They themselves are successful readers, but they do not even begin to know how to break it down for a struggling reader, nor has their university taught them. Schools of education should incorporate, not ignore, the neurological research and the fMRI studies that have informed and shaped these IDA standards. I urge you to oppose Senate Bill 221 and require education prep programs to teach dyslexia as required by House Bill 2412. Thank you.
My name is Monica McGee. I live in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and I am here to give testimony in opposition to SB 221. My story of dyslexia spans four decades and two coasts. It is a long tale of misinformation and failure on the part of our public schools to identify, understand, and appropriately educate two of the brightest members of my family. It is a story that will shadow me most of my life. My brother was identified as dyslexic in the 1970s at a small rural public school in North Carolina. My parents were young and trusted my brother's teachers, who wanted to help but were ill-prepared to meet the needs of a dyslexic student. I, too, wasted valuable time trusting the master-level teachers at my son's elementary school in Lake Oswego, who brushed aside my concerns of dyslexia and advised me that my son just needed time to grow. My son was a dyslexic student hiding in plain sight of his well-meaning but uninformed teachers, exhibiting every possible red flag of dyslexia. What he needed, as did my brother, was identification and explicit, systematic, evidence-based instruction. Only after I stopped listening to his school and pursued private testing in 2015 was my son's dyslexia confirmed. Every day I think about how lucky he is that I could afford to pay for that testing, and I worry about families that can't. Like my dad, who would leave work early to drive my brother to tutoring, I drive my son twice a week for private Orton-Gillingham tutoring so that he can learn to read. I advocate in his classroom because I understand the difficulties my brother faced year after year in schools that had no clue how to help him. I advocate because I see the same lack of understanding in my son's teachers, and because I know from experience that not much has changed in 40 years. Dyslexic students who are fortunate enough to be identified are still at the mercy of an educational system that has ignored decades of research and refuses to adapt. The reality is that one-third of our country's fourth graders read well. Preparing teachers is the key to changing this statistic. Colleges of education who align with the International Dyslexia Association's knowledge and practice standards will produce teachers who are better prepared to help not just dyslexic students, but all beginning readers. School is not just for the kids who are easy to teach, and reading instruction that helps dyslexic students is reading instruction that ultimately helps all students. I ask that you take this opportunity to change the ending to my story and the stories of so many others, because 40 years is enough. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Hello. Hi, Chairman Roblin and committee. I'm Kathy Weirich. I'm opposed to 221. I'm an independent dyslexia consultant. I've been training teachers and tutors over the last 30 years to use the programs that are like the IDA standards. And I've trained over maybe 200 teachers and tutors. And one thing that I'd like to say about this in terms of the people who are concerned, the education schools who are concerned, is that dyslexia is a very specific group. It's not the same as teaching reading to all kids. It's a 20-25%, so they need something different than the other kids. So what I use and I train people in is a program that's closely allied with IDA standards. And it kind of bothers me that people are thinking that these IDA standards are flighty or not very secure or something like that. And so I wanted just to point out that these are standards of the highest quality. They represent the scientific consensus, and they're made up of people who are educators, who are scientists, who have gotten giant federal science grants, clinical clinicians. And each section of the IDA standards has a bibliography, a scientific bibliography explaining why it's there and how the quality of it. So I just want to say that these standards are really great. They're a product of many, many, many years of work. And the people there, who wrote them there's a representative of the scientific community, and they also represent the different accrediting bodies in the dyslexia world. So there's like three or four different programs or groups or accrediting that's part of that. So this is a consensus document over a long period of time with a stellar scientific basis. So anyway, that's what I'm saying.
So there have been a lot of conversations over the last year and a half about whether or not they are scientifically best practice. I was reading through a bunch of it again last night because there's a lot of discrepancy with respect to that from different outside groups. So, not nearly as many actual studies as I had hoped that there would be for Gillingham and Horton, because that's what my brother did in Renton High School. So,
right.
So there seems to be a disparity between that. So
what the studies are is that there's studies on different elements. So there's studies, a lot of studies on phonemic awareness. There's a lot of studies on spelling. So if you go to Virginia Berninger, who just retired from the University of Washington, she's been working on that for many years, I'm sure you've seen her. So the studies have to do with the elements.
Thank you. That's something I need to look at a little bit
more. And that's why
the
IDA standards are set up that way.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you for your testimony. I know it's very hard, so especially for family members that take care of us. I mean, I'm just going to tell you, I have a brother that has gone through the worst kind of things you could ever do, and is basically homeless now, and a bunch of other kinds of things. And my sister still is there helping. So it's a difficult lot in life if things don't go right. And
right.
So thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
So next we have Britton Clark. Is it Hayek? And Lisa Lyon and Diana Sticker. And I hope I didn't massacre too many of those names. So whoever wants to go first.
You guys can go first. That's fine. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and committee members. My name is Lisa Lyon. I am a parent and a Decoding Dyslexia board member. I am here to voice my strong opposition to SB 221 because it would remove any instructional accountability from HB 2412, which was passed unanimously just 2 years ago. As you know, 2412 required university programs to include coursework on dyslexia that aligns with the knowledge and practice standards of the IDA. These standards include foundational knowledge about the building blocks of how to teach reading for all children, not just for those with dyslexia. Since the passage of 2412, I believe the legislature has come to realize that dyslexia is real and that more than 100,000 Oregon students are affected to some extent. Today, I am here to ask you not to second guess yourselves, nor allow the passage or forward movement of SB 221. If all sides agree that dyslexia is real and that Oregon students are not currently being served in schools, the pertinent question is, what is the solution? What are Oregon's universities going to do to adequately prepare teachers to help these struggling students? If the universities are not required to align with any standards, where is the accountability? What would prevent universities from saying that they are already addressing the gaps which we know to exist in teacher training? In 1999, NIH issued the National Reading Panel Report detailing recommendations for teacher training. Since that time, universities have resisted the implementation of these higher standards to the detriment of both children who need direct, explicit instruction to attain literacy and their teachers who are not trained to deliver this type of instruction. Teacher prep programs have had almost 20 years to make these recommended changes, but they have not. One reason universities have given for their opposition to 2412 is because it concedes authority from the state of Oregon to an external agency. The concept of using guidelines and standards from various associations to inform instruction is not foreign. Associations such as the Interstate Teacher Assessment and Support Consortium provide standards for different areas of university coursework, such as Autism Spectrum Disorder, and the National Association of Sport and Physical Education provides standards and benchmarks for PE teachers. We believe that it is smarter and more efficient to implement standards that have already been developed by nationally recognized experts than to waste precious time and money recreating the wheel. I encourage you to set an example for our nation, serve the children of Oregon, and hold Oregon's professors accountable by requiring them to educate new teachers by using the IDA standards as a guideline for instructions. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever's next.
Hi, Senator Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Diana Sticker. I'm a founding member of Decoding Dyslexia. I'm a parent, and I have dyslexia myself. And I'm just going to go off topic a little bit from my previous testimony, but I think what we're getting at is, do university programs, now that they say they're going to teach there are teachers about dyslexia, are they really going to do it? And I really appreciate your question about that, because I think after what Lisa's saying is that after 40 years and so many years of my family not getting what they need, can we really not keep them accountable? And really not hold them to any standards. And the only standard that I can find is the IDA standards. So, I digress. I want to go back to
That's
my testimony. furthermore, I'd like to report on testimony from other individuals, not myself, and other people who couldn't be here today. So about 72 hours ago, Decoding Dyslexia decided to launch a change.org program against 221. And over 3 short days, we have more than 600 signatures, which I delivered to the Senate Education Committee, and over 100 teachers and families made an effort to include personal comments on why they support the curriculum changes in education preparation programs. These comments, again, have been submitted. So it just goes to show you how quickly we can hear other voices, and it's a huge problem. 1 in 5 people have dyslexia, and I think it's just coming to the forefront in our attention in Oregon. In addition, I would also like to inform you of a letter that was written by and signed by professors nationwide who are following this bill closely and oppose 221. They are strongly support teacher training that is aligned with the an international association on dyslexia, or what we're pointing to is the IDA. I've submitted this testimony too, that was signed by these professors, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Very much.
Hello. My name is Britton Clark Hike. That's H-U-Y-C-K. I live in Corvallis, and I'm giving personal testimony today. I am the parent of a profoundly dyslexic son that has experienced the K-5 classroom. I'm here today with him to model self-advocacy skills and also to help model giving him a student voice for what he needs from his teachers. For the record, I'd also like to say I'm a classroom teacher. I'm a certified teacher. I taught high school and middle school science, and I'm currently a teacher on special assignment for the Corvallis School District, and I'm in classrooms K through 12. I work specifically with students that are on IEPs and 504s to help them with their reading and writing needs with technology. So I planned a great testimony. And throughout today, I have added so many thoughts to it that I'm going to give this my best shot to stay linear with you in 2 minutes. First of all, I'd like to express gratitude for all the work that's being done on all the different elements of this, from the classroom teachers receiving training in their education programs, to the point person at ODE, to the districts appointing someone, you know, in the schools. There's a lot of different moving parts. And I'd really like to lean in and oppose what's going on with Senate Bill 221 right now, because I just don't want to see that watered down or weakened. Tying this to those IDA standards is just so critical in just maintaining the full integrity of what these students need in the classroom. I would like to speak to the thought that, 5 seconds left, that this is a general education issue. This is not just a special education issue. These students are included in the general education classroom, and a lot of, I feel, mental health issues can begin early in elementary school that can be real stumbling blocks for kids if their general education classroom teachers aren't well trained in working with them.
You can also rewrite your thing, and you can submit it for testimony. So there's another way to get your stuff there.
I would love to do that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So did any of you participate in the TSPC conversation that took place that we heard from our professor?
I did. It was a committee, RAC treaty, RAC. And Lisa, you were there, too.
I was there once.
Oh, one
and
time.
Did you see coming out of that the kinds of stuff that are in this bill or not?
I believe what came out of that committee included the IDA knowledge and practice standards. So the current rules do include the knowledge and practice standards. So I'm not seeing how I'm seeing that we are comfortable and happy with
okay.
what came out of it. Yeah.
Okay.
As long as the IDA knowledge and practice standards
okay.
are included.
So you didn't feel like a bill needed to happen at the end of that meeting?
No, not
okay.
No.
That's what I'm just trying to
okay.
figure how where we got today. So
yeah.
thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Any questions? Okay.
Thank
you very much. So it must be Marty Stockton. Christina Lincoln and Jennifer M. Pulse. And then there's only one more group after that. So we are going to get through all of them. And I do have the chocolate for people who stay, so the kids will stay. And I do want to say, as they're coming up, the one thing, other thing. As a dyslexic teacher, I was a math teacher, and so when I first got into my classroom, I would always tell the kids, if I hear them laughing, I know that my three or whatever is going the wrong direction, but I can't see it anyway, so if it really bothers them, be sure and tell me what it was so I could turn it around for them. So don't. It is not a choice you make. I just want to make sure that all these kids out here understand what happens to us and the way our brains work is not your choice. It's who you are, and you need to feel good about being who you are. So go ahead.
Great. Good afternoon. My name is Marty Stockton, and I'm providing testimony in support of House Bill 2412 that was passed unanimously in 2015 to require universities to provide training on dyslexia and to oppose the new Senate Bill 221. In late 2015, our family was just beginning our journey in understanding dyslexia and navigating a system that inadequately responds to the needs of our eldest daughter who has dyslexia.
Take a breath and it's okay.
In October 2015, our daughter Ruby was a fourth grader at Alameda Elementary School in Northeast Portland. At the parent-teacher conference, my husband Matt and I were strongly encouraged to have our daughter privately assessed for her difficulty in reading. You see, to go through the Portland Public Schools process of evaluation, we were advised would take the remainder of the fourth grade. We collectively agreed that we could not afford to lose any more time to assess a fourth grader struggling reading, writing, and spelling. In November 2015, Ruby was privately assessed at the cost of $1,000 and was diagnosed with dyslexia. In January 2016, Ruby began twice a week private tutoring using the Barton Reading and Spelling System, an Orton-Gillingham approach to reading instruction. This month, our family is committing to three times a week tutoring at the cost of $65 a session, now through September, in preparation for Ruby entering Beaumont Middle School. To not have received a dyslexia diagnosis until the fourth grade, Ruby is working incredibly hard after school to catch up with her peers in the near-term expectations of middle school coursework. There are three points that I need to make in my testimony. First, our public school was and continues to be unprepared in supporting students with dyslexia. Ruby's educators from kindergarten through third grade were unable to recognize the signs and symptoms of dyslexia in our daughter. We were advised to have her vision exam in the first grade, which we did, and the exam confirmed 20/20 vision. In both the first and second grades, Ruby began the year not meeting reading grade level, but managed to meet it by the fourth quarters. In the third grade, Ruby's struggle in reading became more apparent, and several reading interventions took place in the classroom, including the use of the Smart Reading program, which, by the way, pulled her out during art, which is her favorite subject. In the third grade was also when, out of the blue, Ruby began spelling her name R-U-D-Y, Rudy, instead of R-U-B-Y, Ruby. At home, our then 9-year-old began using phrases, I have a bad brain, and I'm stupid, during outbursts and tantrums. We noticed other behavioral changes related to the growing lack of confidence. The dyslexia diagnosis has been a gift in many ways, including providing a clear explanation to our daughter on why she processes information the way she does, and to begin the hard work of counteracting issues with self-confidence and anxiety. Secondly, my second point, schools and districts and the Oregon Department of Education should not continue to expect families to depend on privatized services to meet the educational needs of students with dyslexia. The current practice leaves so many families and their children in our greater Northeast Portland community and throughout Oregon without assessment and appropriate instruction by many educators with little to no understanding of dyslexia. The burden is greater on Oregon's communities of color, low-income, and immigrant and refugee families. I just like to say, to look in the room and look at the demographics of in the room and who is not in the room today. While dyslexia is equally represented across demographics of race, ethnicity, income, Oregon's public education school system perpetuates the educational disparities by deliberately not addressing the needs of students with dyslexia. Oregon wins when everyone achieves their full potential, when children graduate school, college, and career ready, and when reading, writing, and spelling is taught, acknowledging that 1 in 5 students have dyslexia. My third and final point, the current Senate Bill 221 does not take into account the lived experience of students with dyslexia, their families, nor the educators that are frustrated by the lack of knowledge and recognition of dyslexia and the current lack of preparation to provide appropriate instruction. To strike out language pertaining to dyslexia is to discount and ignore the experience and the needs of children with dyslexia. It is reasonable to expect that our educators are properly prepared to meet the needs of their students. At this time, the International Dyslexia Association, IDA, definition on dyslexia and the IDA standards are the best practice. Please do not repeal this language. The current Senate Bill 221 is at best a debate on word choices and semantics, or worst is an example of certain university faculty unwilling to be inconvenienced by those students with dyslexia and not working in collaboration with the parents, educators, and districts that struggle in their support of these children. For the university education programs, an acknowledgement of dyslexia, building a knowledge basis and standards around dyslexia may be a shift and need to broaden efforts and or a cause to restructure. For students with dyslexia, a diagnosis and appropriate instruction is life-changing. As part of a public education, it will be both transformative and achieve greater educational equity. Oregon's legislation on education needs to reflect the experience and needs of our students and ensure that all children have the necessary support and opportunities to thrive, both as individuals and as contributors to our local communities, our economy, and the state as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you. You used up their time. So other than that, it went really well. But no, we're going to still give you 30 seconds.
Thank you.
No.
Sorry. My name is Christina Lincoln. As a certified dyslexic therapist and a certified academic language therapist and an RTI instructor in the Portland School District, I am here to oppose Senate Bill 221 that removes International Dyslexic Association's basic standards from Oregon's teacher preparation programs. If passed, the teacher preparation for helping dyslexic students will remain unchanged, prolonging a 50-year failed educational policy for our intelligent but struggling readers. Redacting the best practice standards of the IDA from teacher training curriculum will be a disservice to our dyslexic student population by denying them the best opportunity to become successful readers, which is critical to their future success. Moreover, it would be a disservice to teachers in training. It would leave them inadequate and unprepared to remediate the neurological disorder that affects fluent word identification, decoding abilities, and spelling with dyslexic students. To eliminate the IDA standards would be knowingly and intentionally creating an unequal opportunity for the dyslexic students of Oregon. One objection is that such best practice and research-based standards is unfair to other students with disabilities, and the scope of the content is too narrow. In reality, the IDA standards both overlap and transfer successfully with other disabilities affecting reading skills. After 7 months as the RTI instructor at Whitman Elementary, a Title I school, 43% of my RTI students have moved from red intensive to yellow strategic. 19% have moved from yellow strategic to green. They are now reading at benchmark. Every third grade RTI student in my class recorded a 20 to 30-point increase in fluency using the DIBELS assessment. Not one of these students have been professionally diagnosed with dyslexia, yet the IDA standards and methods I currently use have transferred successfully to achieve dramatic results in teaching other students with disabilities and struggling readers. For example, in my class, I have students diagnosed with ADD, autism, I have ELL students, I have students diagnosed with behavior, emotional, and students living in severe poverty. My last paragraph, redacting IDA standards will deny future teachers the skills that will successfully remediate the dyslexic disability and protract Oregon's failure to accommodate dyslexic students. The standards not only offer best practice methods for dyslexia, they transfer and overlap to help all struggling readers becoming successful readers. On behalf of all future teachers and the dyslexic population of Oregon, I urge you to reject Senate Bill 221. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. I'm the mother of a dyslexic and represent the 20% of children who have been failed by the current system. Every one of my child's teachers were not properly trained, which became apparent during one of our IEP meetings when the teacher was asked about the reading program that she was using, for which she responded, well, a little of this and a little of that. It got worse with the SPED teachers, of which my son had five SPED teachers during his 8 years, K through eight. When I brought up dyslexia, she said she could go to Goodwill and get some phonics books. I have that taped, actually. It was so obvious that these women had no idea that they were what they were doing when it came to reading instruction. Turns out my experience is actually backed by scientific data, of which I recommend everybody read this, because once you read this, you will absolutely oppose this 221. In 2000, the National Reading Panel examined scientific evidence about beginning reading practices that work to prevent reading problems and to maximize reading outcomes, even for students with reading disabilities. The NRP, which we call it, findings form the basis for all effective reading instruction. The teaching of explicit and systematic phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension, they're called the Big Five. The NRP findings were prominently cited in both No Child Left Behind and the reauthorization of the IDEA Act. Studies done in 2015 by the National Center for Teacher Quality of over 1,100 institutions, in which 99% of new teachers are trained, discovered that 71% of these institutions do not teach the Big Five. In the journal Scientific Studies of Reading, college professors were not even able to tell you what the Big Five was. And less than 50% were able to identify phonological awareness. Only 29% knew that frogs had two morphemes. Teacher knowledge is critical. Children need explicit, systematic, structured language. Not language experience, not whole language, not literature-based instruction. It's clear that college professors are not following the Big Five. Why? These professors were not put through the rigors of the Big Five and therefore did not pass it on to other graduate students. And the problem perpetuates itself. Turns out there's only 25 colleges that are actually following the Big Five, and Oregon has none. So what do? Do we beg the professors with tenure to change their ways and keep our fingers crossed, or do we legislate the changes needed to teach and maintain a literate society? For the past 20 years, our organization, Kathy Wyrick can attest to this, has trained teachers and tutors in the Big Five, and every teacher who's gone through our program has said, I wish they taught me this in college, followed by, why didn't they teach us this in college? I'm not interested in well-intentioned teachers. I'm only interested in well-trained teachers. Thank you
very much. Oh, you need to identify yourself, too.
Oh, I'm Jennifer Paltz.
Thank you.
With the M, you put so
yeah,
nicely.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And it looks like our last group, Susan Foreman and Michelle Burnett. Is there anybody else that didn't speak that wants to come up? Okay, just wanted to make sure. She wants to be the closer.
Fine.
No.
I'm a rookie, so my first visit here, I'm honored to be here. My name is Michelle Barnett. I'm here as a parent. I'm in opposition to this bill. I have submitted written testimony. I came in person to give some of my thoughts as well. I'm the proud mother of two junior high students who are currently in public school in Oregon. Both were only recently identified with dyslexia within the past 2 years. We started with public school, kindergarten through second grade. Struggles with reading and writing led us to private school for a while. In both settings, despite numerous warning signs of dyslexia, none of the well-meaning and highly educated teachers were equipped to help our children progress. We, like most of the other parents we have now met with dyslexic children, have recently paid privately not only for educational testing, but also for one-to-one tutoring to give our children the basic decoding and spelling skills to bring their reading and spelling up to grade level. My eighth grade daughter will spend intensive time over the summer finishing that program so she can be at ninth grade level before going to high school on her own time. I have even become a certified tutor myself to be able to teach them at home and begin helping others. We have undertaken significant costs, and therefore we cannot accept the objections by the teacher colleges associated with this bill, suggesting that the cost and effort of educating teachers about dyslexia is too much. Families with moderate or severe dyslexia are either paying one by one extreme personal costs per student, I haven't even mentioned the emotional costs, or are unable to afford the help. The better way is to address this upfront in school.
The business case for our society is clear. I have reviewed plenty of other previous testimony outlining the facts about eventual incarceration that many of those who do not receive the help that they need experience. What has astounded me the most about this experience over the past 2 years is that our story is not unique, and that the information about effective reading intervention and appropriate accommodations is already readily available, and even studied and proven information by the National Institutes of Health. The information has been available for decades, yet is not in the hands of our teachers. I could not believe that when I found that out. I mentioned in my written testimony that my prior experience includes 24 years in healthcare plan management. This situation with dyslexia in our school system looks to me like a healthcare system that would allow medical schools to omit education about asthma and diabetes. Imagine sending your child to a pediatrician who has zero training and no knowledge of some of the most prevalent chronic conditions and the evidence-based proven management and treatment. Now imagine your child cannot breathe. But you're told, don't worry, they'll probably outgrow it. And yet we send our children to school with teachers who have no training about dyslexia, and it impacts 20% of the population and is the most common reason for reading failure. I implore you to require any college or university that is training teachers to teach them about dyslexia. Dyslexics can excel in school if they receive the right kind of instruction for their learning style. Thank you for taking the time for a thorough discussion.
Thank you. And Orton Gillingham, by the way, I think most of the people know here, it was 1930s, so it's not 70 years ago, it's a little longer, but the original people.
My name is Susan Farmer. I'm a dyslexia tutor and a licensed teacher. I'm opposing 221, right? That's the correct number?
That okay. is the correct
okay.
number.
I am opposed to removing the IDA standards from that. And as an example, I brought some state guidelines that have come out recently. Although only one of them mentions specifically IDA, I wanted to be very specific regarding what do they say they are requiring in their dyslexia law. Washington has pilot projects which, quote, must provide research-based multisensory literacy intervention. Nevada, no wonder somebody needs to cross the state like that other person testified. Explicit direct instruction that is systematic, sequential, and cumulative, and follows a logical plan of presenting the alphabetic principle. Multisensory instruction that incorporates the simultaneous use of two or more sensory pathways during teacher presentation and pupil practice. New Mexico. Schools shall provide timely, appropriate, systematic, scientific, research-based interventions with progress monitoring. RTI is the other name for that. Colorado, in-school dyslexia training, identification in higher education programs to train on dyslexia, evidence-based progress monitoring, scientifically-based interventions, interventions consistent with response to intervention, a tiered continuum of intensity. Texas, purchase programs for students with dyslexia. In other words, teachers can't just develop their own. Oklahoma has a training pilot program. It is the intent of this legislature that the Oklahoma State Regents for Higher Education enter into a contract with a nonprofit education center which is certified as a multisensory structured language training institute for the purpose of establishing a comprehensive dyslexia teacher training pilot program. I have several more here that I won't take time to specifically read. I will upload this to allow you to look at this more thoroughly and what other states are saying requiring multisensory. I would like to make one final comment. You said when we came up here we could comment also on either bill. With regard to Senate Bill 1003, I am opposed to the part that says the department shall develop guidance regarding best practices. This legislature designated a dyslexia specialist for this state and an advisory council, and the purpose of that advisory council was to develop standards. and they are recommending very, very specific prescriptive things. And that's what these other states are also requiring. So when you take that away and say they're going to give guidance, that's actually taking power away from the advisory council that you requested, from the dyslexia specialist that you've asked to advise regarding what's going on. So issuing guidance is really watering down what this state needs. So I encourage you to take that paragraphs or section 7, I guess it is, on page 2 of the bill out of there and allow for the prescriptive that is being objected to for the same reason of these things that I said stated that other states are doing. They're mandating these multisensory RTI interventions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for these two? No? I think I will have our TSPC director come on just for a second. I just want to ask one question. So thanks. I don't know if you all know Monica Bean, but she's pretty awesome, just so you know. So I just have one question, basically. We have gone through the rules and implemented the bills that were passed the last time. And so is that done? Do we have to have this bill? And on the CAPE part, the Section 3, do we need more time for those standards to get implemented over time? I just want to know what your best feeling about that is.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monica Bean, Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Thank you for the question. Removing the language, the consistent with the international, the rules are in place. So if you remove that language, it still says that that there has to be instruction provided on dyslexia. So it's just that one line that comes out. Dyslexia instruction is still required for all EPPs. Okay. The second part of that of the bill, if this bill did not pass, then yes, it would be problematic to the institutions with the educator preparation programs with regard to meeting standard 4 of the national accreditation standards, which currently is CAPE, C-A-E-P.
Okay, which is kind of separate. There's two different parts to this bill.
That is correct.
Okay. That was important for me to know, decide where I
yes.
want to go from here. Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other questions for? And all I can say is thank you for being here. You're doing an amazing job, and I've appreciated the work that's been going on. So thank you.
And thank you, Senator.
Okay. With that, there's no more business to come before the. I thank you for staying. We'll figure out where we're going to go from there. May I accept? We do have a quorum. How do you guys feel on the tax credit?
Look, we can send it to a committee that may never open. So
wait.
Okay. Well, that's where it's going. So it's going to the tax.
Oh, Jesus. That's right.
But I asked Mark. He said okay.
Okay. So. Are you okay with that one?
Sure.
Sending it to JDA. Okay. So we're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 1003. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 565. Give us a short explanation, and then we'll send it off to JTAX. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And before they go, I did promise chocolate, and I do have a large bag, so if they want to come up and get a piece of chocolate. Wait 1 second until we take a vote. Okay. So what? I'll wait for a motion.
Let's just vote.
Motion.
Let's just vote. Make the motion and let them do it.
Yeah. Chair, I make a motion to move Senate Bill 565 to the floor with a do pass. Actually, it'll go on with a referral to JTAX by prior reference.
Okay. Senator Lithicum moves the Senate Bill 565 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that it be sent to JTAX by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
No.
Is there any opposition?
No.
It's done. Thank you. Now we're going to close the Education Committee for today. And you can pick the color you want. The blacks are dark chocolate. And actually, there's enough for everybody, so if parents want to come up. And you can take one.